So now continuing, second chapter, verse 41. Let students, according to the order of their varnas, wear as upper garments the skins of black antelopes, spotted deer, and he-goats, and lower garments made of hemp, flax, or wool. The girdle of a Brahmin shall consist of a triple cord of munja grass, smooth and soft, that of a kshatriya of a bowstring made of murva fibers, and that of a vaishya of hempen threads. If munja grass and so forth not be procurable, the girdles may be made of kusha, ashmantaka, and balbaga fibers, with a single threefold knot, or with three or five knots according to the customs of the family. The sacrificial string, that means the Brahmin thread of a Brahmana, shall be made of cotton, shall be twisted to the right, and consist of three threads, that of a Kshatriya of a hempen threads, and that of a Vaishya of woolen threads. A Brahmana shall carry, according to the sacred law, a staff of bilva or palash, a Kshatriya of vata or kadira, and a Vaishya of pilu or udumbura. The staff of a Brahmana shall be made of such a length as to reach the end of his hair, that means the hairline right here, the top of his forehead. That of a kshatri to reach his forehead, that means this place here, that means the, what do you say? Agya chakra. Means just between the eyebrows. And that of a vaishya to reach the tip of his nose. Let all the staves be straight, without a blemish, handsome to look at, and not likely to terrify men with their bark, and with their bark perfect, unhurt by fire. Okay, so these are the different elements of the Upanayanam, is that when one receives the lower cloth, the upper cloth, the staff, and the Brahmin thread. So these, and the girdle, these are all part of it. So basically what it is there for the protection and chastity of the Brahmachari. To help them, the because of their innocence and that, then the thing is that earth comes as the belt for their protection. So to give chastity, so it's seen like a sister. The upper cloth is like knowledge. The staff is also to bring forth that knowledge and the good qualities. You can look here, actually. Okay, so according to Gopal Bhatta Goswami, okay, in Upanayanam, then so Gopabhatta Goswami says here that after we've discussed before what is necessary, the qualifications, then it says, child should be fed a little prasadam, he should be clean shaven with sika, bathed, decorated, and dressed in one piece of clean silk or cotton cloth. So then after, then here, what is it? Okay, after the Acharya, he takes blessings from the Lord to perform this sacrifice. Then they perform the Vrata. The Brahmacharya wants to be initiated into Brahmacharya. This is an important point, is that other things here, we're not asking the child if they want. Anaprasana, this, that. They don't know what's good for them. But Upanayanam means that the point of questioning has come, atato brahma jigyasa, that the point of questioning, the consciousness is able to understand this finer things. There must be that question. Because in education, unless there's questioning, it doesn't happen. There must be interest to learn, there must be questioning, there must be service. Then the teacher can actually give knowledge. And once the teacher is given knowledge, then the student, then the next step is the questioning. He hears Shravana, then he must question. He must understand how to apply it, he must practice it. Then this will give him realization. So here we see is that the teacher has asked the child, the child comes forward and the child says, please accept me, accept me into the vow of brahmacharya. You train me as a brahmachari. And then the child says what his name is, and then they pour the water from the hand. So sankalpa has been performed. So now that is a contract. In the modern, you have a piece of paper and you have so many things that are there and, at the bottom, then you sign your name and that's considered contract. In the Veda, it's holding water in the hand, and then after making that commitment, you pour that water from the hand through the fingers. And that that means it's done. So the one is accepted in the court of, material law and all that, and the other is accepted in the, court of the of all those who manage the universe. Because the sun sees this, moon sees this, wind sees this, the directions see this, the earth sees this, the air sees this, and then they accept that it's been done. Like that. So if one is materialistic, then this will go into Chittagupta will write this for Yamaraj, and then one's piety and all these things will be accepted there. And if one is doing this for purpose of serving Krishna, then that will be accepted by the Lord. Okay. The teacher takes the student's hand, and means that friendship between the student and the teacher, like that. Prabhupada mentions in the Bhagavatam, or the Bhagavatam verse itself says there must be firm friendship between the student and the teacher. So that the teacher takes the hand of the student, like that, and then with this, then he protects him. First thing they do is that he asks the student to follow the strides of the Lord, or follow the directions of the Lord, what the Lord gives that he should be done. It means the rules and regulations the Lord has given, to follow those, that is the brahmacharya. That is the important aspect, that he's learning, he's practicing and following what the Lord has given him. And with that, that friendship is there, he's following the Lord's footsteps. In other words, the Lord is the teacher. But the teacher is then representing, because we're not seeing the super soul. The super soul is the one who is delivering us. The super soul is the one who is training us. But we don't see that. So he sends to us teachers from outside, our spiritual teachers, those who are going to guide us in our life. And then through them, then we see actually the knowledge that the Lord is giving. So this is a, very important basic principle. So then one understands that one is delivered by the Lord. This is always a big thing. Who's delivering? It's actually the Lord delivers. He is Mukunda. No one else can deliver the living entity. Right? Prabhupada also mentions that when the living entity is very strict, then Maya has tried so many ways to entice the living entity into material consciousness. When one is not, Maya herself goes to Krishna and said, "You please accept this person, they're very serious," right? Because that's her business to check. And then when the devotional attitude is developed very nicely, then Radharani, she goes to Krishna and says, "You please accept this person." So if we understand the factual process, only Krishna is liberating. So then that answers all these questions on, there's somebody born in New York and over there, and then he became a devotee, and now suddenly he's the big Mahabhagwat, does he deliver? Then all that goes away, because it's Krishna who's delivering. But because we are unqualified, see, this is the essential elephant, essential element. Why do I always say elephant? Essential element. Is that, yes, one always has to be careful of very essential elephants. Or one could look at it, elephants are essential. But amongst essential elephants, in the principle of elephants being essential, some elephants are more essential than other elephants. So this particular essential elephant. So is we always, the natural thing is one can tell, this is a major point in the devotional process. We see the whole thing is interwoven with the devotional process. It means the Vedic, the Pancharatrik, the Bhagavat, for the conditioned soul, you cannot separate. Means it can't separate them. Means you can say, well, this is Bhagavat, this is Pancharatrik, this is this Vedic, but in their application, they're all intertwined. You know, like you have, let's say I cook a sabji. You know, I have cauliflowers in it, I have potatoes in it, I have peas in it, I have water, I have so many different spices and other different things. But you know they're all in there, but when it comes out, you can't separate them. There's some major things. You can see that here's a cauliflower, here's a potato. But with all the spices and all that and the flavor, it's all homogeneous. So this is very essential. Many times we try to simply take all the elements as they are. I go into the kitchen, I cut cauliflower, potato, I stack them very nicely on the counter, and then I say, this is a cauliflower sabji. Right? And then everybody comes in and picks up the raw potatoes or the raw cauliflowers and they eat it, and they all become dissatisfied. Why? Because it is not a sabji. It is the elements of a sabji. But it has to be put together. That's the culture. That's the etiquette. So without doing that, in other words, you may have the elements, but if you don't know how to cook, it's still going to be bad. So even though you have the elements of the Vedic culture, if you don't know how to apply them, it's going to be a disaster. And when it's a disaster, then whose fault is it? Can the cook, does the cook blame everybody else? Well, it was the pot, or it was the counter, or it was the sabji, or it was... No, he didn't know how to cook. So... So the teacher then is, So these elements are all very, very nicely entwined in each other, and that is the culture, the application. So that one can understand what's going on, you dissect the things, right? That's a common thing, is you want to know how something works, you dissect it. And then after you've dissected it, you start to know what all the parts are. And then when you understand the parts very nicely, then you start to understand how the parts relate to each other. And once you understand how the parts relate to each other, then you learn how it all works as a homogeneous whole. Right? Just because I have spelling doesn't mean I know English. Or just because I have grammar doesn't mean I know English. I have great handwriting doesn't mean I know English. Like that. I know how to lay out the page and indent at the paragraph and how much to leave at the top and the bottom and on the margins and all that. It doesn't mean I know English. These are all elements of it. When you put it all together and it comes out nice and you're able to communicate, then you can say you know English. So in its application, and that's there. So many of the time, that's why Prabhupada says, philosophy without culture is mental speculation, because that is exactly what one has. Right. If you have the culture, it's applied. It's very, very, very obvious. But if we don't have that, it's speculation. So one has to take it to that point. So to take it to that point means you have to know what it is. You have to see it, experience it. It's not intellectual. Because many will sit around and intellectually discuss Varnashram, but they've never seen it, they've never experienced it. So naturally, then they don't know how to cook. So either they leave the sabji on the counter, or they think, well, I kind of think that it's all mixed up and all that. So they'll mix everything up on the counter, or maybe someone will put it into the pot, or they'll put each different item in a different pot. Maybe someone will try to cook it, or cook one of them and not the other. You know, like that. But it won't come out. They won't be able to do it. So one has to... The complete thing is there. So we see here is what's going on is the whole process of brahmachari means that the brahmachari himself wants to be a brahmachari. You know, he knows what he's getting into. The second thing is he takes shelter of a teacher to train him. Then the teacher takes the hand of that student, that friendship, that bond is made. He shows that you are actually following the Lord. It's the Lord who is educating you and saving you. Now, because we are unqualified, Therefore, we have to go to somebody. Means the Lord in the heart can save us. He's telling us what to do. We don't listen. So because of our disqualification, the Lord sends a guru outside. So because we are conditioned, we know the Lord through this person. Therefore, the person himself understands that this person who has come to me, the guru, he is saving me. Why is he saving me? I'm not saying he is in the platform of Mukunda. It is because he is representing Mukunda, and if he is pleased, Mukunda is pleased. Then we are liberated. So for us, the practical application of liberation is that guru comes to us, he accepts us, he is our well-wisher, he is pleased, the Lord becomes pleased because of this process, we get liberated. It's very important to understand. Like that. So this means that, okay, now if we take it like that, okay, so he doesn't liberate us, it's Krishna liberates us. So now if we take it according to just that aspect of the tattva, then we can very easily just sideline that person. Why? Because of our impersonalism. Because simply seeing things only through tattva takes away the personal aspect. We do that to break ourselves from the material world. But we get into the spiritual world because of personalism. Right? When we see the material world as just the material energy, and that all the different things that are here are illusion, our attachments, our desires, our all these different things, then it comes back to we understand it is just Brahman. It is the Lord's energy, it's Brahman. So this particular, pebble, stone, gold, doesn't make any difference. They're all just the material energy. They have no value for the soul. So one uses that aspect to break from the material world. Therefore, the Brahma bodies are considered transcendentalists because they break from the material world. But they're not on the platform, they're not eternal spiritualists because they haven't connected themselves with the Lord, so they'll fall. Right? So that impersonal can work to get one out of the material world. Impersonal meaning seeing the Brahman, Brahmeti. You know? And then we understand the Lord in the heart is saving us, Paramatmeti, that's the aspect. But unless there's Bhagavaniti, you don't get out of here. You cannot go back to the spiritual world without accepting the principle of Bhagavan. Like that. One can't. One will not make it. Because that means interaction with people based on relationships with the goal of transcendental affection. So then, this means that in that, it's personal. Krishna is a person. The people who he sends to help us are people also. Right? It means the Lord arranges it. We see the Lord's controlling. Not a blade of grass moves without his arrangement. So that means that by his arrangement, we have somebody comes in front of us. They don't have to have dropped out of the spiritual world. They simply have to have come in front of us by the Lord's arrangement. So now, as personalists and ones who want to get into the spiritual world, we have to recognize that this person is the instrument of the Lord. Therefore, the instrument does work. Right? The instrument does work. It means like you're cooking, you're using a spoon to stir the vegetable. So we understand that the person who's pushing the spoon is the cook. They have actually cooked it. But that spoon is what the subji knows. Right? That's the point. The subji does not necessarily understand the hand that is pushing the spoon. So the subji knows I didn't get burnt on the bottom because the spoon kept pushing me around. So therefore, because of this personal nature, we owe our life to that person. Because that person is representing the Lord. Our life is owed to the Lord, but how are we going to do that? We can just do that straight. That's a common devotee. It's not a real sampradayic devotee that the Lord takes seriously. This is the problem with Meera. Is that it was just her and Krishna. Devotee. But she's called a rough devotee. It's not sampradayic. She's not going to get back to Godhead in this way. And we can see that her determination became, distracted. By association with Tulsidas, she became an impersonalist. She went to merge into the Lord. She was using her so-called bhakti as the means, as her path, you know, her tools. But it was not actually bhakti like that. Because bhakti means serving the Lord under his servants. That's actual bhakti. So then, you know, for us, for the living entity. So then, we have to understand is due to our position, we're unqualified, therefore the Lord has to use this system coming to us through someone else. So we owe it to that person, we owe our life to that person. We see them as our liberation. Right? So we can downgrade this relationship as long as we want to downgrade the process of devotional service. The same time is we can't also just have sentiment. It means if you have the culture without the philosophy, Prabhupada says that's sentiment. So someone just sees my guru and that's it, and couldn't care less about anybody else or this or that, that also is a problem. Because otherwise they don't understand the whole picture. They're like a child. The child just sees the mother in the beginning. You know, that's all. They don't understand there's a father, there's a whole family, there's a community, there's a nation, there's, you know, the planet, there's the universe, you know, then there's the material world, the spiritual world, and within, they don't understand anything. The sentiment is nicely directed. It's properly directed at proper persons. But it is still just sentiment, and sentiment can waver, as we see with Mirabai. She had sentiment, but no philosophy. So it's also dangerous. Better than someone who knows the philosophy but doesn't have the culture. Because at least then they're personal and they deal nicely. But someone who has only the philosophy, not the culture, can never deal properly, practically with anybody.
You said better one who has philosophy, not culture.
No, I said better is one who has culture, not philosophy. Oh, yeah, okay. Is that. Because then at least they're behaving properly, and then they can come in contact with the philosophy. So, it's just like the example Prabhupada said, someone who's following non-Vedic religious principles and someone who's following Vedic. The one who follows the Vedic is better situated. Because then you only have to introduce the proper understanding. While for the other one, you introduce the proper understanding, still they don't have the form that matches that understanding. You know? Just like if you want to do some very serious work, you have to have serious tools. You know? You can't cook with a screwdriver. You know? You need the proper tools. So then, then this comes here, is that the teacher is pointing out that here, he says, may Vishnu take your hand, may Narayan and Mahavishnu take your hand, may Mukunda and Prabhavishnu take your hand, by this action you are a friend. Vishnu is your teacher. So the Lord is the teacher. And the teacher himself feels he is simply representing the Lord. That's all. It's the Lord's instructions, the Lord's process. So he is representing that.
Before you said he is dear to Mukunda.
He is dear to Mukunda, yeah.
And Raghunath Das Goswami, in his Mana Shiksha, third verse, he says, Mukunda Prishtatve Smara. Shigurum Mukunda Prishtatve Smara, Padamajasam Nanina. Mind always remember your spiritual master is he who is dear to Mukunda.
Yes, he who is dear to Mukunda.
Mukunda Prishta. Yeah.
So one could say, well, they can only be dear if you're a big, you know, Mahabhagavat. But then how is it that we can in the same sentence say that all devotees are dear to Krishna? So the point is all devotees are dear to Krishna. Why all devotees? All living entities. Krishna's entered, he's not just in the heart of the devotee, he's in the heart of every living entity. Even the worm and stool. So he's very dear to everybody. So, I mean, everybody is dear to him. So then, those who then recognize and become devotees are more dear. Those who then take up the proper practice of devotional service are more dear than that. So then, let alone someone who tries his best to help others, right? The preacher is very dear to the Lord. So that cannot be disregarded. We can only disregard if we don't understand this combination, the philosophy and the culture. You know? So, here. Okay. Then, after that, then he protects the child with different, like, kind of nyas. And then he says, okay, now you are a brahmachari. He's been accepted. He gives his different orders that he has to do. Brahmachari must follow various orders. He must be clean. He must do service. He must control his senses. Like this, these aspects do. And he says, I will do it. It means the teacher gives the order and the student says, I will do it. In other words, it's with knowledge. So this concept in the Vedas of just something is just learned by rote and that's it, and there's no critical thinking process, is generally an erroneous assumption. Many people think that the Vedic system is simply just things are shoved down the throat. No, from the beginning, before the lesson started, this process that I understand what I'm getting myself into and I accept it. The whole thing is based on this. I mean, this is the ritual before the teacher even starts teaching. Right? This is before he's even started to test. Very serious. He's already done basic testing. But now he's going to do serious testing. Before he gets down to serious study. So already in the process, the teacher knows what's going on, the student knows what's going on. Because the Vedic culture means they have to know what's going on. And those who can work in this way, they can take full advantage of the Vedic process of learning. Those who can't, then one has to make adjustments. They have to learn for a shorter period of time, or less subjects, or more, you know, more general, like that. But if one wants to take someone very deep into the Vedic knowledge and culture, then they have to be able to have those critical thinking skills that they themselves want to apply and accept. Then, Okay. Then he wraps the waist of the child with the kusa, three times in a clockwise direction. And then the brahmachari himself says, "This belt is the consort of the Lord, pure and auspicious, like a sister, freeing and protecting one from bad words and acts. It preserves the purity of one's varna, brings strength for inhaling and exhaling breath. I have obtained this belt." So, by the grace... Oh, yes, here. "This belt is the protector of truth, the greatest wealth of austerity, which prevents injury, causes victory over enemies. O secret belt of fortune, please surround me completely. As your wearers, may we not bring harm to you." So here is the Lord's consort, who is pure and auspicious, like a sister. Then she frees one here from all bad activities of the mind, body, mind, and words. And gives us strength to perform our activities. And that we feel very grateful that she has come and asks that she completely protect us, surround us. Therefore the belt goes around like this three times. And that we may not harm her. Meaning we may not do things, even though that protection is there, we do not go against that. We do not go against this. In other words, we ourselves consciously make that effort to follow the vows, and we do not in a conscious way fall from those vows. Sometimes due to bad habit, things may happen, but that is accidental. But if there's a plan, and one understands what's going on, and one continues with it, then this will give harm. So this is the belt that is given there. Then the sacred thread. Then, you know, "You are the sacred thread for sacrifice. I tie you with this thread for the purpose of performing sacrifices. Then let the sacred thread is most pure, born at the time of the appearance of the Lord, long before. Put on this shining white thread, bestowing long life. Let there be strength and energy." So this, the thread then means the sign of one who is fit to perform sacrifice. means they have taken this vows, they understand they're following the Lord through other qualified devotees, and therefore then they are able to do sacrifice. Like that. So his vows, austerity, you know, performance of sacrifice, then the deer skin. I am giving you this deer skin, which is the light of the sun, the presiding Lord, strength, energy, and fame, eternal and effulgent, chaste, giving valor, giving long life. So the light of the sun, that's where the enlightenment comes from. That is the energy. It's also the light of the sun, we understand, is a reflection of the Brahman. Brahman is then coming from the Lord. So this is the Lord's energy. And from that, then we gain our knowledge. And it gives so many good qualities. Strength, energy, fame, chastity, valor, long life. All these things are coming. So that is another aspect here, is that knowledge then is being gained. Then he receives the mantra, Gayatri mantra. And then he receives the stick. Then it says, you being glorious with knowledge, make me glorious with the same knowledge, O glorious one. As you are glorious amongst the devas, may I be glorious amongst the brahmanas. So then that knowledge aspect is then, this is the most prominent in here, the stick then is that. It with knowledge, then one can move through the world properly. We see with the stick, it helps us moving, it protects us. So the intelligent person protects himself with his knowledge, and he moves through the world with this knowledge. And then also the aspect on that light of the sun, it is the protection. The deer skin is protection. It protects from rain and all kinds of other things, from the cold. It is used in so many ways to protect us. And this element of the sun, the energy, the power, is also the devotional energy, like that. So the devotional activities. So we have the friendship with the teacher, accepting the path of the Lord, and the Lord is our you know, how do you say, our maintainer, our friend, our well-wisher, like that. Then we are, how do you say, then protecting ourselves, controlling the senses with the girdle, the kusgrass girdle. Then the how do you say, then taking up the devotional path, sacrifice, and knowledge. These things are here. Then the last thing is then he begs. He starts begging. So this is the humility that is there, and he's begging on whatever he gets, then he gives to the teacher. Like that. So that is the essential elements of the Upanayanam, of of the process, what's going on. And what we see is that these things will come out in the points that it gives what is the real aspects of Brahmacharya, here the Manasamhita. So that's what's happening. So here then, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, these things are designated so that one knows what one's duties are. From the earliest age, one knows that this is this nature, and he fixes on that. You'll generally find also, amongst very great people, one asks, you know, what added to their greatness, what training or experiences. And many times you see from a very early age, their parents are always telling them that they're going to become good at this. They can become good at this. And so from a very early age, they fix their mind. This is what they're going to do. So by this breaking up, the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, their nature, then they know what they are, and they know that they can become good at this. They know what is their limitations. They know what are their strengths. They know what is the etiquette, how they will deal. And therefore, then things can run very, very nicely. Otherwise, you have a boy who, let's say, he has... The modes are a little stronger on him, but if it's not designated that is his position, then he has influence on boys who are in more sattvic modes, because they're all the same. But if it's understood, okay, here is a boy who's a Vaishya, or here's a Kshatriya, and here's a Brahmin, and they actually have those qualities, it means we're talking about qualities, then we see that the influence is not so great. And the boy knows, yes, I have to become a leader. Right? If it's just a matter I have to do the things in the ashram and that, he may or may not like to do. but I have to become a leader. Therefore, I have to become serious at what I'm doing, you know? Or I'm going to have to, you know, take up, you know, seriously in the world, do my business and take care of cows and do all these things. And he knows what he has to do. So his training has meaning for him. The Brahman, he knows he has to take this very seriously. But it's all a matter of presentation. Otherwise, it can look as though it is very, what do you call it? It may be, oh, you're dividing them up and all that, but that's what goes on anyway. Good management means you have a top as a director of the company, and you have the other people like that, and you have your secretaries and your supervisors and everybody like that. A good structure works like that. So the Vedic system works like this. But no one feels bad because they know whoever's doing what and everything. If it's properly, the atmosphere is right, everybody's happy. If it's used wrong, if it's used to establish somebody as superior to another, then that becomes very difficult. Like this. One may feel the liberality is going to be the kind thing, but many times we find that liberality is not actually kind. Because then people don't know who they are, can't find a direction, you know, like this. They go through the educational system, they have no purpose in life, no goals. So then what is the real harm? So now, the Vedic system is not liberal, it's broad-minded. So there's a great difference. Liberal means we let the rules go, and we don't care. It's not so important. Broad-minded is we're very strict about the rules, but we understand that the application of the rule for one person may be different for another. So the principle of the rule is never broken, never. The detail we may adjust, because the scriptures are very broad, right? The scriptures are very broad, like that. So that is the difference. Broad-minded, mahatma, that's broad-minded. So therefore, they're very kind and very, because they find something for everybody. But liberal means we just break down the principles and everything because we are uneducated in culture and in philosophy and that. So liberality is a defect. And it may, for the senses and for the body, seem that it's very kind. But for the soul, it is a great disqualification. Therefore, then one who is overly liberal, and then we find that there's a breakage in the culture and all that, it is actually a transgression against the soul. It is abusive to the soul. It may not be to the body and the emotions, but it is to the soul.
Atmahana,
yes. So the scriptures, especially the Upanishads, are very strong on this point. Like that. You know, one has to be careful. The killers of the soul, like that. Those who disturb one's understanding in that way. Of course, that means that naturally if one is nicely taking care of the spiritual aspects, then the emotional and sensual are also taken care of. That's very essential. But the, what do you say? But to take care of just the material emotions and senses without dealing with the soul, then that is also very bad. Right? Both are bad. Okay. Then we see is that it gives these different aspects here. Then it says, let the staves be straight, without a blemish, handsome to look at, not likely to terrify men, with their bark perfect, unhurt by fire. So unhurt by fire means you heat wood and then you can bend it. So to make it look nice, if you have to bend it, then that's too much endeavor. And it should look nice, it should be straight, it should be very good to look at. It shouldn't be terrifying, because the brahmachari is supposed to move. He's supposed to be the child of the society. So if he has a very, you know, stick that terrifies people, it may be nice for his, you know, budding false ego. But it has nothing to do with the relationship between him and the teacher and the others, you know, other equals in the school or those outside the school that he's going and begging from. It must be that they see it as very something very pleasant and nice, you know, and that is, this is the brahmachari staff that helps him, you know, because knowledge is not fearful. The staff represents knowledge should be pleasant, because pleasant means it's been applied, right? It means, you know, we see Krishna in the Gita when he says knowledge, he gives the definition of knowledge, and we see they're all very nice practical qualities, humility, respect for authority, cleanliness, all these different aspects. And we see the austerity of the tongue is that we speak knowledge pleasantly, like that, so that it benefits who we are speaking to, like that. And so, therefore, the stick representing knowledge must be very pleasant. It can't be a disturbance like that. One cannot wield one's knowledge to disturb others.
Why don't our brahmacharis carry staffs?
Why don't ours? Prabhupada started it in Vrindavan. He had them dress with the, you know, the piece of cloth and the danda and that. But then what was found is the kids used them to beat each other with, and you know, they just, you know, they weren't up to the standard. So then, you know, then they just kind of discontinued. But Prabhupada in Vrindavan wanted that. He had a sannyasi as the head of the school, teaching Vedic mantras. They were doing, you know, he was doing Shaligram Puja. They would, you know, do things in this way with the Sanskrit and very kind of like orthodox flavor.
Jashodanandan.
Yeah, Jashodanandan. They had him, you know, they had the boys dress in a traditional brahmachari way, like this. With the ideas that, you know, established like that, but the boys weren't qualified at that time, and so that aspect didn't work. And then, you know, later on, the teachers also proved themselves to not be so qualified.
But they had method blocks and all that.
No, because here we see is that there's the Gopal Bhatta Goswami says shaved head. Uh-huh. See, because if you're going to do worship, then what? See, what? There's two systems: one, you let everything grow, or one, you keep it shaved. So for us, we follow the shaved principle because we do worship and all that. Matted locks as you live out in the jungle, right? There's no facility to shave out there. Plus, you know, the lifestyle and everything, and it goes along with it. But for us, then the shaved is the thing. So they had shaved head seekers and like that. So it was quite nice. But the kids just, you know, somehow or another couldn't come up to the standard at the time. Like that, like here, Prabhupada started the Gurukul here with six, you know, Nepali Sanskrit Shastris. You know, they could speak Sanskrit, they knew Sanskrit, they themselves grew up in these Gurukuls, in a grass hut. So we see Prabhupada always tried to start in the traditional ways and establish something very nice. Like that. Having taken a staff according to his choice, having worshipped the sun and walked around the fire, worshipped the sun meaning he accepted the mantra, you know, and then he's like this, turning his right hand towards it, means you always keep the auspicious things on your right. When you go around something, it's always like you go around Govardhan, it's with your right side to Govardhan. Or you go around the fire, go around the deities, like this, always on the right side. The student should beg alms according to the prescribed rule. An initiated Brahmin should beg, beginning with his request with the word lady. Bhavati, a Kshatriya, placing the word lady in the middle, but a Vaishya placing it at the end of the formula. So that means the Brahmana is saying, Bhavati Bhiksham Dehi. Right? That's what he says here, right? An item. Oops, here. Yeah. Bhavati Bhiksham Dehi. That's how he starts. O good woman, please give alms. So, this is for the Brahmin. The respect there, Bhavati, mother. Then, Bhiksham is the process that's going on. And Dehi is what is supposed to be happening. I mean, she gives alms. Now it says the Kshatriya places that in the middle. So that means, yeah, Biksham Dehi, no, Biksham Bhavati Dehi. And then he places at the end, Biksham Dehi Bhavati. So with a Kshatriya, then we see that the Biksham, then that's the, how do you say, how did that work? One is you can tell who they are by how they beg. And the other aspect is what is the importance here, like that. Means is for the Brahman and that respect, and like that for the Kshatriya. Then more just the practical, the Biksham, that aspect Biksham Bhavati Dehi, and then for the Vaishya, then Biksham Dehi means I want the profit Bhavati. Right? See, it matches the thing. The Kshatriya is very practical. The Vaishyas, they want the result. And the Brahman is then the respect and all these different kinds of things. These aspects become the prominent aspect. So it fits the mentality. Does that make sense? So there's nothing in the Vedic culture that has not been thought out. Right? It's been thought out very, very well. Like that. Let him first beg food from his mother, or of his sister, or of his own maternal aunt, or of some other female who will not disgrace him by a refusal. In other words, the first begging should be from, ideally, his mother, if not available, then somebody who is a relative or a well-wisher. Right? And because the first time he begs, it should be auspicious. He should get something. Right. Then after that, as he goes, then by begging, then sometimes he'll get nicely, sometimes he won't. You know, that's the whole process of humility, is that he begs, and then sometimes he's taken care of, sometimes not. Okay. Having collected 51... Huh. Yeah. Huh.
How much is begging this, just for the training, the building character, and how much actually...
It's both. It's simultaneous because the teacher is not taking any money. Like that, the teacher is not taking any money, so therefore, the place has to be maintained. So either they would have the system where a king or a wealthy landlord or someone has given either vast tracts of land for farming or given villages. The tax from that village comes to the ashram. Or, you know, some way is set up some kind of a money, a maintenance thing, then the begging itself is how they maintain the ashram. Because they just go out and beg what they get, that's what they cook, that's what they eat. Right? The gusa grass goes wild, the deer skins they get from the kshatriyas, like that, you know, cloth they get here and there, people will donate. So then all their needs are taken care of by this simple method. Still with the score? Sorry. Yes, so the humility aspect is there. So they would beg anyway, just for that purpose of humility. But otherwise, both aspects are important. That's why dakshin is only after. It means the teacher, the Vedic system is after you've finished the training, then according to the student's abilities and position, then he gives a payment. You know, out of gratitude for what he's received. Like that. Brahmins don't work for money. Like that. Education is free. Like that. But everybody comes and gives something to the Brahmins, you know, gives charity to the Brahmacharis and all this, so it goes on very nicely. That's the whole system. Because the point is you look for qualified students, not for those who can pay. Student is qualified, you take him. Student's not qualified, even if he's rich or the son of a king, you don't take him. Who belongs in the school must be there. Who doesn't belong should not be there. So before, the Brahmins were very strict on this point. They refused to work with substandard material. Because if you work with substandard material, the substandard material does not actually appreciate what they've gotten. so then they're ungrateful. Means you train them, but because they don't have the intelligence to learn, afterwards they'll blame, "I didn't learn anything." They don't have the character, so even though you're very accommodating with them, they'll consider they were not taken care of enough. So therefore, they weren't dealt with. Not because they didn't want to deal with them, but they know material nature, they know human nature. And if you deal with those who are improper, you're going to get a bad result. So neither the society will be benefited, the student himself won't feel satisfied, and neither is the teacher benefited. So they were very, very careful about this. You know, so it's very practical.
How do you work out who's qualified to become a student?
How would you work it out? That would be seen by how they perform their service. Main thing is the first thing that would be checked is their character and service attitude. You know? In other words, the what do you call it? Pranipata and the sevaya would be seen. And then just general their inquisitiveness in not so important subjects. You know? You wouldn't deal so much with the heavy philosophy, the Sanskrit, the Vedic mantras and things like this. One would teach, you know, the lighter aspects, the reading and the, you know, basic mathematics and, you know, hear stories, hear the histories and, you know, essential things, but that aren't so weighty in their presentation or need of understanding. And one would see a lot the service. Service was very important, you know. At least 3 times a day, major times the students were doing service in the ashram. Besides, yeah. I mean, in the morning they were collecting everything and preparing and performing all the sacrifices. You know, noontime then they were begging and taking care of those kind of things. In the evening then they were cleaning the ashram and doing the evening yajnas and all these kind of things. Like that. So they were. Then it's stated that the teacher would watch the student for 1 year. Then after a year, then say, "I can teach you or not." Because he would have learned something there, and he would have gotten cultural training and all that. But if he's not up to the standard where the teacher felt, what I speak, he understands, and he can really apply. It doesn't mean that the student is unqualified totally. It just means that that relationship between that particular student and that particular teacher is not fit. There may be another teacher who can get through to that person. So that's why the testing period is there. So you can see, actually, does this student and teacher match? Like that. And if not, he would be told and then he would go on to another place. The teacher is not allowed to keep him beyond that just because he does service, because he has a nice service. He would see, "I can't teach this person," and so therefore he would be sent back so he could go to another educational institution that could teach him. Like that. Mm-hmm. And this way then the benefit would be there. The teacher couldn't keep him just because, well, he does nice service, but he doesn't have a brain, you know, like that. They weren't allowed like that. But the same time as the teacher had to be satisfied that this student actually can learn what they have to teach, because each teacher has his speciality, what he can teach, and he has his methods to teach it. And so someone of a similar nature can learn from that person. Right? That is very much there. Like someone is, let's say, very bold, so then they can train people who have that inclination towards that boldness, or they appreciate that boldness. Someone else may be very teaching in a very scholarly way, so that attracts those kind of students. You know, you speak in a particular way. So that the same principle applies in the spiritual master and the disciple. The spiritual master has to see that the methods that they use for training then are compatible with the student and vice versa. How the student learns, how he has to be taught, is the way that the teacher feels comfortable in teaching, and the way the teacher teaches that the student is comfortable with that. So it's very individual. Education is totally individual. The individual students are dealt with individually, and the teachers are individuals. And then you make matches. That's why before, generally you'll find is a Brahman can be is a good teacher. A Brahman can learn anything, teach anything, but it doesn't mean they're great managers. So in the tradition, they would keep 12 students. Because 12 students could just live in their house and they can just take care of them. More than that, then it gets to be a problem. It's very difficult to take care. So for that reason, then they would how to say? Yeah. So this way you could have, in Dwarka alone, I think there was 1,200,000 acharyas, means who are running gurukuls. Just in Dwarka, 10 miles by 10 miles. Of course, it was the spiritual realm. What's his name? Maharaj Ugrasena had a personal bodyguard of, I think, 10 trillion persons. So even though it's 10 miles, but 10 miles by our calculation, it seems it's a little bit bigger on the inside. You measure the outside of the walls, you get 10 miles by 10 miles. But if you measure inside, you'll get unlimited. So, whatever. But they had that many acharyas there just to teach the children. Yes?
Were they mostly sannyasis or grihasthas that were gurus?
Most of the time you'll find it means in the Vedic sense, it means how you say, how the Vedic, how it manifests in the other three yugas, other than Kali, generally it would be grihasthas. Though it wouldn't have to be. Durvasa was also. He had students and like that, Vishwamitra. But because generally they just lived in the forest and were just moving around. So it would be very difficult for them to maintain an educational institution like that. Though we see Durvasa did, though it many times would be a disturbance for others. But he did maintain it like that. And very large. He was, a good organizer. And I think Vashishta, he also had 10,000, but he's, Rajguru for kings, like Lord Ramachandra and like this. So he's, Rajguru means he has to know how to organize. So then he can maintain. But others, tradition would be the householders, so they would just have their home, and in their home they would have the students stay with them. But in the Kali Yuga, then with the missions, established by Lord Chaitanya, through the different acharyas, the four acharyas and Shankara, then we see many times the prominence of that sannyasis can lead the educational institution. Though many times the teachers, especially if it was a big organization, would be the grihasthas, the pundits, like that. But the philosophical and very essential teachings, that would be done by the head of the mat. Well, things like learning the Sanskrit or learning astrology or learning, these different little technical, very technical, things, that would be learned from the grihasthas. But the essential philosophical and understandings and the particular, interpretation of the shastra that makes it that particular line, that would be done by the sannyasis many times. So you have that any of those, either or a combination. Either it's just sannyasis or it's just grihastha or a combination. It doesn't really matter. Main thing is that you're dealing with those who have the proper qualifications. They actually have the brahminical nature. So they're able to properly teach. So then they study them for some time, like this, and then they see that they actually can learn. They have the character to learn, and they have the intellectual ability to learn. And then with that, then there is happiness, There is satisfaction. Okay. Then 51, having collected as much food as is required from several persons, right? One shouldn't beg just from one person. Brahman, it's not advised that he takes all his maintenance from one source, because then he becomes dependent. He should take from many sources, like that. Shouldn't be all from one place. So here he should beg from a few people. And having announced it without guile to his teacher, means, just guile, doesn't say, guile,
craftiness.
Pride. Craftiness. Okay. Oh, okay, yeah. So, in other words, he's announced what he's gotten. Mm-hmm. He doesn't hide anything. There's no duplicitousness here. Then let him eat, turning his face towards the east, and having purified himself by sipping water. So after doing achman, then only then he'll eat. So whatever he gets, he turns that over to the teacher. And then accordingly, then they go. If they're begging uncooked things, then that will be turned over to the teacher, and then it will be cooked, and then everybody in the ashram will eat. If it is cooked things, then that's his portion, or how much he requires, he keeps that extra is given, and then that goes to take care of others in the ashram. So like this, then the begging goes on, and then the eating goes on. So 52, his meal will procure long life if he eats facing the east, fame if he turns to the south, prosperity if he turns to the west, truthfulness if he faces the east. That's so. Truthfulness if he faces the east, fame if he turns to the south, prosperity if he turns to the west. I think one of these is supposed to be the north. I think it's truthfulness if he faces the north. Because the east is where the sun comes. Sun gives long life. Right? Fame if he turns to the south, because Dharmaraj, Dharma, and that one becomes famous for Dharma. And then prosperity if he faces the west. I'm not sure who's in the west. Who's the...
Varuna?
No, Varuna's in the northeast. Oh. But then they do have those four corners. He may also be like that. But it's also Vaishyas, they generally, the main aspects of opening is on the west, because prosperity comes from there, you know, like that. And truthfulness, I think, faces the north.
I think it's Soma to the west.
Soma to the west. Ah, because nourishment and all that. Soma is the moon, so then all that aspect comes. And who's in the north, northwest? The wind corner. Huh? Vayu. Mm-hmm. What's the planet? Oh, well, we'll get into that later. Okay, so in other words, basically faces any of the directions, it's good. So one doesn't have to worry about that. 53. Let a twice-born man always eat his food with concentrated mind after performing an ablution, means after washing his hands, mouth, and feet. And after he has eaten, let him duly cleanse himself with water and sprinkle the cavities of his head. In other words, he must clean his hands, wash his mouth, clean everything very, very nicely. Like that. And, you know, do achman, because then with achman, then he's sprinkling and doing all this cleaning. So by doing it, by this cleanliness, then that purifies the mind and brings everything to a very, very fine level. Because only when there's fine consciousness can there be fine understanding. 54. Let him always worship his food and eat it without contempt. This is very important. When he sees it, let him rejoice, show a pleased face, and pray that he may always obtain it. Food that is always worshipped gives strength and manly vigor, but eaten irreverently, it destroys them both. Because the point is the Lord is giving. Whatever the Lord arranges, that's what he has. So he's dependent upon the Lord, so the Lord has given that. So if he doesn't deal properly, then that means one is because of his senses. He doesn't like something because it's not up to what his senses were wanting. So that's not standard. That's not a brahmachari. Shudra maybe, but not a brahmachari. Like that. Brahmachari is satisfied whatever comes. Like that. As long as it's up to standard, it has to be, you know, proper, clean, and all these things, can't have hair and bones and all these things in it. But if it's proper, edible things, then it may be fancy, maybe simple. But he accepts it, that this is what the Lord has given me. And he very happily accepts this. You know? Because otherwise, then it's the ego, it's the senses, all these different things that may come up, and it's not good. You know? It's not good if he deals. And we see here, gives strength and manly vigor. So from the manly vigor means, because with health, strength comes, that's the external. is that you eat something, it turns into physical strength. It means the strength is there, the senses are strong, and one can then perform one's duties very nicely. One has the ability to perform the duties nicely. The manly vigor means is then from that strength we see is that from the, it slowly goes from the skin to the fat, to the muscle, to the bone, to the blood, I mean to the marrow, to the blood, to the semen, and that creates the finer, the subtlety, the strength of the brain, strength of the intelligence. So that subtleness must be there. So the inner strength of the subtle body and the external strength of the gross body both must be healthy. Then one can properly perform his act duties nicely. And if not, if he irreverentially deals, then both will be destroyed. So he won't get good health because he's not satisfied with it. Plus, it will affect the subtle body. The subtle body will be affected. It'll increase the lust and all that also. Because the lust comes from, I'm thinking, the ego is there and the senses. And that creates your lust. So, excessive eating is prejudicial to health, to fame, and to bliss in heaven. It prevents the acquisition of spiritual merit, and it is odious among men. One ought, for these reasons, to avoid it carefully. It means if he overeats, then it'll be bad for all these different aspects. You know, health naturally, if you overeat, you can't digest it, then that turns into toxins, and then that goes into the system, then those toxins, then they sit in wherever part of the body is wet, and then that creates the disease in those parts, like that. To fame, you know, if one is known as a glutton, it's not very good for one's fame. Then one always has a problem because one can never follow the etiquette or culture when, you know, one wants more, but one, you know, how to get them to serve you more when either there's less or everybody else is not eating, or it becomes a great problem. So then one naturally then will say things or do things that everybody understands that this person is not so cultured. You know? Yes.
How do you put that together with the culture
of akantu?
Serving as much as possible.
Yeah, means it's a wonderful like relationship. Is that the person serving are trying to give you as much as possible, you know, pleasantly, and the who is eating should only take how much he requires.
Because other also very difficult to take when people push.
That is there, but generally you find that's not on a daily platform. That's only when you go to somebody's house for a special thing or it's a feast. Then those kind of things, it's understood that, you know, more will be going on because it's the relationship. But on a regular daily basis, they don't push like that. If you're everyday eating, they'll always be very serious to check many times that you do want it, that you're not just being shy. Because you'll generally find that in a gentle society, they give you the first time it's accepted very, you know, graciously, but not with, you know, over, you know, you don't ask for more than what they give you the first time. You don't say, yeah, give, more cheese. Yeah. No, you don't do that. And then when they come the second time, you always politely refuse. But then they must, the server must check that you, do you actually not want, or are you just being polite? So then they must try to convince you to take more, either by you know, being more insistent and all that. And then if they see that you don't become more insistent, means, in other words, when they go to give you more and they insist, if you then kind of like relax your insistence on not taking, you know, it's kind of like, okay, if you insist, then they'll take, then you give. But if you see that their insistence increases, that they don't want, then you know that they don't want. They're not just being polite, but either they're getting full or they want to move to the next preparation. Like that. So that relationship, that the subtlety must be there from both sides. Like that. That fineness must be there. So that's a Yeah, one shouldn't be shy, meaning that if one wants, one should accept. And if somebody offers, then you accept it. It means that you may be very gentle, but you'll accept. It means the whole point is it's very gentle. It's like if someone says you want, you don't say no. Like that, and it's like taken as a no. This is that, you know, okay, you know, it's like it's very, in other words, you don't say, would you like, yeah, that's right, about time you asked, you know, it's like, so it's like, you avoid that kind of stuff, you know, it's like, in other words, there's supposed to be some gentleness in the whole dealings. Now, one may feel that, well, this is quite external, but no, there's reasons behind it, and it's actually the felt and understood culture. If one just follows it because it's the rule, it may be external. If one understands why it's there, then that depth is there. It's solid. It has substance to it. So that's generally the thing, is that if one just approaches from the rules, it's sentiment. There's no substance. If one just approaches from the philosophy, it's speculative and no substance. If one has both, then it actually has some depth. So then, you know, that's the thing. Because here it means to fame, means by a big feast and eating a lot, one doesn't lose one's prestige, you know, like that. You know, that's okay. That's everybody. Feast means everybody has a good time. Those who are, you know, critical, you know, like Ramachandra Puri, then they may take it otherwise. But otherwise, for those who are cultured, then no, a feast means, you know. Everyone has what they like. It mentions that Dhari Das Thakur's disappearance, that that when Lord Chaitanya started to serve, he would give enough for 5 people to eat. So then, you know, on each plate, because that's how he would eat. So then, you know, Srup Damodar and others told him, okay, you sit, we'll take care. And then, you know, made the point is everybody's waiting and they're not going to eat until you eat, you know. So, okay, then he sat down. Then they would serve, and it said that they would serve very quickly, very efficiently, and accordingly what they knew what everyone liked. They know if this one liked the sweets more, they give him more, just insist more and give him more, you know, bigger servings, and someone liked the fries more, give that, or someone liked this or that. They just know, you know. And so they always try to please by giving more in that. So that natural, it's a whole exchange, the whole thing. So that's another here. Prevents acquisition of spiritual bliss in heaven means that if you're interested in the heavenly planets, you're not going to get there if you're not controlled in the senses. And then spiritual merit, acquisition of spiritual merit means that,
It would be too heavy to go up.
Oh, yes, that's a very major point. Mm-hmm. Go up. Acquisition of spiritual merit, you know, unless the senses are controlled. And, yeah. Then let a brahmana always sip water out of the part of the hand, tirtha, sacred to Brahman, or out of that sacred to Ka, Prajapati, or out of that sacred to the gods. Never... Oh, that's far out. Ka, Prajapati. Never out of that sacred to the mains. So in the hand, when you're doing achman, means if you're worshipping the Lord, and which means what we do, and even if we're dealing with respecting, you know, the demigods or that, it's always by worshipping the Lord first and offering their prasad to that personality. The water is always sipped out of the place of Brahma, which means the up the base of the palm, where the palm meets the wrist, like that. The point of the demigods is the place, the opposite side, where the palm meets the fingers. You know, and then for the what is it? Actually, Brahman, then sacred to the gods, is then to the left, means the, what do you call it? On the right palm, then where the at the point where the little finger joins the palm, at that joint there. But it never out of the part where opposite, where the where the forefinger and the thumb meet the palm. That's for the forefathers. So that's for the, you know, ghosts and stuff like that. So we never, that's not used.
So Shraddha, do they do that?
Shraddha, they might, but generally the water is poured out of that side. That's why it's backwards. It means the other way is it's easy, but that's backwards. That's why when you're serving prashad, someone serves backwards. That's for the when shrads you do, it's always backwards like that. It means I have a spoon, I put it in the bucket, and then if I hold the spoon, I'm holding the spoon with my right hand, and the spoon is then going from the right to the left, and then I will tip it towards the person I'm serving. That is considered backwards. I must always... Yeah, it means... No, it's counterclockwise. It's going backwards. It's clockwise from my side, but from your side it's...
Yeah,
it's counterclockwise from my side. Yeah, from your side it's clockwise. Yeah. In other words, yeah, clockwise. You're right. Yeah, so then it's backward. I've never thought of it that way. Yeah, then that's improper. What you have to do is it's going out from the hand outside. What you have to do is take from the bucket and turn the spoon so you turn it inside. So your hand is going counterclockwise. So it's just turning towards the thumb instead of away. Like that. Then anything else on this? They call that part at the root of the thumb the tirtha sacred to Brahman, that at the root of the little finger the tirtha sacred to Prajapati, and at the tips of the fingers sacred to the gods, and that below the index and the thumb the tirtha sacred to the manes. Let him sip first water 3 times, next twice wipe his mouth, and lastly touch with water the cavities of the head, the seat of the soul and the head. So that's in the Achman, then one is, after sipping water, then one is touching all the different places of the body, like that, in the full Achman, like that.
But when should full Achman be done?
Basically here, it's generally before any major activity. So here, before eating, specifically it's saying after eating, that's any time that there needs to be more major cleaning. Like that, and even in some texts, and it'll mention that at those points it should be done twice. You know, I'm not sure if that means that the full process must be done twice, or the sipping of the water is done twice, and then the touching of the different parts of the body is done once, like that. That I'd have to check, but either one would be acceptable. Yeah, he who knows, so that's getting there. And it mentioned about you sip the water afterwards, right? So they mentioned not overeating, right? He's begged, right? So in begging, then he must eat. So that's described eating, and then after that he must do achman. So now it's describing achman. So it's very, very nicely scientific in how it goes through. He who knows the sacred law and seeks purity shall always perform the rite of sipping with water neither hot nor frothy, with the prescribed tirtha in a lonely place and turning to the east or to the north. In other words, the water should also be pure and proper. Why smiling? Hot, frothy water? In other words, one should not use hot beer to hot 7-Up. Yeah. Well, a brahmana is purified by water that reaches his heart, a kshatriya by water reaching his throat, a vaishya by water taken into his mouth, and a shudra by water touched with the extremity of his lips. So means to get it to the heart means there must be concentration. You must sip. It's not that you take more water. It's the concentration. You'll see it'll go down to the heart. If you actually do achman and concentrate on it, you'll see you can get it to the heart. Otherwise, the concentration is less. It'll go into the mouth. You'll get to the throat. Otherwise, if no concentration really at all, it'll go into the mouth. And if you don't know what you're doing, then at least it'll touch your lips. You don't know what's going on. You know? Like that. Because generally, you see, shudras aren't regularly doing these things at all. They didn't go to the gurukul. They're not regularly doing sacrifice. So there's some things they have to do. So then they're told to do achman. They don't really know what's going on. So at least they get it there and it touches the mouth. And they're purified. They get the same benefit. So the brahman must be very concentrated. Then it'll get to the heart. Okay, then. Is the offering finished?
Yeah.
Okay, so then we'll finish here. Then we'll go on with the, goes with the Brahman thread, and then the girdle. Okay. Stephanie? Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.